Coming up today, Stephen Hawking and others are urging humanity to consider the implications of a society rich in artificial intelligence and has signed a letter to that end. Plus, what reasons could you come up with to justify growing maggots inside your body? Someone's got an idea for you, and we're going to talk about that. And David Cameron has gone mad for Snoopy, or something like that. Maybe the Snoopers Charter, or British people's privacy. We'll find out next. This is the Wired.co.uk podcast, your weekly guide to the important and interesting, from science and tech to David Cameron and the fundamental rotting away of British democracy. I'm your host, Nate Langston. I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk.
And I'm Liat Clark.
And I have to say thank you for a second week in a row to all the incredibly lovely messages that we've been receiving about the fact that I'm leaving the podcast. We've had quite a few, and we've had a lot. I've had quite a lot on Twitter. And I've been very touched. Not literally. No one has physically come up and placed their hands upon me and said, "Nate, my hands are on you. I know you don't know who I am."
That comes next week.
It may come next week.
Yeah, on your last day.
But it hasn't happened yet.
I've got a special handsy surprise for you.
Really? Yeah. This sounds like an HR violation. Well, no, I mean, if you want to stop me in the street and put your hands on me, listeners, then feel free. You can't. Please don't. I will have you arrested. I'm doing a new podcast, though. I've decided to set up my own independent podcast.
Oh, really? What about?
So I'm going to ramble every week about technology. Just about tech, my views, that sort of thing.
Excellent.
So look out for that if you're desperate for some Nate in your diet.
Competition.
Not really. Okay. A bit different. You're not on mine.
Well, maybe I'll be featured every now and then.
Maybe. Live plans.
We can have you back.
This is good. A crossover. Okay. Yeah. I can be like Buffy, you can be Angel. Or actually the other way around, I suppose.
No,
I'd
much prefer to be Angel.
This has gone on long enough. Yeah. Let's do the news. Now, this week, We could not really mention the Charlie Hebdo atrocities happening over the channel. And we are going to be talking more broadly in the second half of the show about privacy and David Cameron and the encryption of the web and whether this is needed to tackle terrorism. And are we giving terrorists a hiding place by allowing freely encrypted chat and web privacy? We have a lot to say on that matter. Liat is going to be leading that in part two of the show. But first, we wanted to talk about something, well, I don't want to say equally worrying, because it is a very, very different type of story. But there is maybe cause for some concern if you are Stephen Hawking, who, along with the company DeepMind, has signed a letter urging for AI oversight.
And we need that. Why? Because, you know, inevitable robot uprising?
Well, in a way, yes. I mean, this has been signed by the UK founders of the company Google acquired last year, DeepMind, which is an AI company of sorts. And the letter has come about, that has been signed by those guys and Stephen Hawking and Elon Musk and other researchers and academics working in the fields in and around artificial intelligence, who say that a letter is needed to call for something that effectively researches what the societal benefit of AI is and puts in place some sort of oversight to make sure that we're doing things in the correct manner. Because we do not want robots developing artificial intelligence and enslaving us all. This is the concern we all rightly have in our dreams all night.
Of course. I mean, this keeps me up a lot. And it's, you know, quite frankly, they're just saying, let's not carry out this research willy-nilly. It's advancing apace. Let's make sure we're doing this with that nugget always in the back of our minds that we need AI for societal benefits, not to, as you said, undo society, the very fabric of it, by destroying us all.
We need to take into consideration, absolutely. And I think that in a very weird sort of way, it's like saying it might be all well and good bringing back the woolly mammoth to feed people in times of, you know, a post-apocalyptic crisis. But what if the mammoth gets out of our control and stomps all over us? It may not be the ideal solution. We have to have oversight here. So up until now, and this is according to the letter that was signed, the field has focused, quote, largely on techniques that are neutral with respect to purpose. However, as developments continue quickly, we think, despite being nowhere near the levels that we saw in the film Her, i.e. creepy autonomous AI.
Easy to fall in love with.
Yeah, we need to keep an eye on the developments to make sure that the systems are, again, quote, robust and beneficial. Says the letter, there is now a broad consensus that AI research is progressing steadily and that its impact on society is likely to increase. And it goes on to say that the benefits could be huge, such as the eradication of disease and poverty not being unfathomable. As a result of AI. Now, I find that to be fantastic, and the letter links to a paper outlining some of the key areas of research that it thinks we should give our full attention to. This includes things like autonomous vehicles potentially prioritizing one human life over another, to AI surveillance powers in the context of privacy rights. Those two are extremely timely, given that we're talking a lot at CES about self-driving cars and automated parking and assisted driving. And of course, we're talking a lot about privacy in the digital age in which we reside. So this is pretty good. It's some good PR behind it, getting people like Stephen Hawking, who's not afraid to put his neck on the line. Yeah. Elon Musk, who in many ways is sort of, I don't want to say a modern day tech Jesus, but he's performed some things that seem quite miraculous to me. What do you think, Liat? Do we need the Court of Artificial Intelligent Rights?
Yeah, absolutely.
Do we give machines a pension plan if they don't enslave us all?
Well, I mean, I'm less worried about their rights. I don't know how mean that is. As I am things like the autonomous vehicles is potentially the thing that we're going to see first, other than things like email sorters, which perhaps not quite so life-threatening.
Not to begin with, but let's not forget that Einstein was, of course, a patent clerk. He was just going through papers and all of a sudden, bam, special relativity, and then bam, general relativity, and
bam, I've taken over the world.
Exactly. So
could happen.
You know, big things can come from hands in little rooms.
Yes, I totally agree with that lovely picture.
Thank you. Is the acorn behind this oak of an opinion?
But the autonomous cars thing, I mean, that is, you know, do you train an autonomous vehicle to abide by the rules of the road first and protect the passenger first? Or, you know, how do the rules of the road versus some cyclist that's doing something really dangerous and you should really be putting their life before anything?
It's a philosophical dilemma.
There are so many different, you know, circumstances that could arise that human beings will deal with their very rich experiences and knowledge and ethical groundings, which AI, how do you give that to AI?
How do you give that to a human? I mean, I remember going back to my old philosophy classes being given the moral dilemma of, there is a train track and you're standing next to the point switch. There's a speeding train. It's got no driver racing towards the tracks. You have to send it one way or the other. On the one track, there's a newborn baby. And on the other track, there's a homeless bum. Mm. Which do you send the train down?
I wouldn't make that decision.
No, but you might have to. And that's the point, is that we have to come up with code that factors this in. And then there are knock-on effects like insurance and life insurance. And could you somehow hack the programming so that a car kills your great-grandparents so you can inherit their wealth? And it just turns out it wasn't murder. It was the car's bad artificial decision.
I mean, do you think humans aren't very good at making a lot of these decisions? Do you think AI could do it better, the baby versus the homeless individual?
I refer to the Star Trek brand of thinking on this, in that computers can be very smart, but we still had Vulcans who think in pure logic.
I'm not sure that gives me an answer.
It means that I don't think that we should hand off all life-threatening decisions to machines just because they can do it, but maybe it needs to be augmented. But these decisions involving, you know, a car verging off the side of a road and potentially hitting Mrs. Smith, or verging off a little bit farther to the right and taking out two kids on the way instead of Mrs. Smith...
I hope Mrs. Smith isn't listening right now. Apologies if you are.
There's probably one Mrs. Smith listening. It's a hypothetical Mrs. Smith. But those decisions have to be made in a split second.
Yeah.
So augmenting is not necessarily going to be a factor that comes into play here. It's we if we're going down this road, figuratively, I mean, and literally, I suppose, then we have to come up with code that somehow augments a human's take on the situation, as well as what an artificial intelligence thinks is the correct decision. I don't know how that's I don't know how that could work. And that's kind of what this is all about.
Yeah, which is why it's a comfort seeing these names on this letter. These are people who spend their life researching, and Stephen Hawking's name is a nice comfort in there.
Indeed. Well, let us know what you think about this, particularly if you've read the letter. It's worth reading. We've linked to it on the website. If you search wired.co.uk for AI oversight, you will find that, or Stephen Hawking, or DeepMind, or one word, you'll find that. And let us know, podcast@wired.co.uk. Do you think that this is a good move? And maybe you can give us an example of whether you think that a car should have full autonomous control over, let's just carry on with the example, who is hit, you know, person A or person B. Is there a right or wrong way to think there? podcast@wired.co.uk. Maggots, Liat. Not every day that we look down and see them crawling around our innards and praising them in the name of science, and yet, apparently, according to some entomologists, that is worth putting up balloons for.
Yeah.
Says Liat Clark of wired.co.uk.
Yeah, this is a curious story about two curious characters, two entomologists that are reveling in what they are calling the birth of botflies that they raised under their own flesh.
And for one of them, this is the best bit, this wasn't even the first time one of them had done it. They'd had one previous growing botflies under your skin experience, obviously decided to do something different.
Yeah, it failed. So he was like, oh,
try it again.
Gonna get an adult one this time.
Who are these people? I don't want to say nut jobs.
These people.
But who are these intriguing characters, and what are their goals?
Oh, I will no doubt pronounce their names wrong, so apologies. But Piotr Nasgrecki from the Museum of Comparative Zoology at Harvard, and Gil Wizen from the Zoological Museum of Tel Aviv University. They're both insect nuts, insect mad. And now they're telling their stories to the world about how they raise their lovely offspring. They appear almost emotionally attached and invested in this. For them, you know, they research these insects their whole professional lives, and they've really got to see it up close and personal in a way many of us never hopefully will. So going back to the botfly first, if you don't know what a botfly is and how it burrows into your flesh, hopefully it will never happen to you, but it happens because of mosquitoes. Mm. They get kind of captured by female botflies, which lay eggs on them and then let them go. The mosquito bites you, and when that happens, the heat from your body causes the eggs to hatch, and they fall onto your skin and just burrow on in there. Lovely. So we're going to take the example of Piotr, who went on holiday to Belize, you know, researching these beautiful creatures in nature, and got a few mosquito bites, came home, realized one was not healing. Then, he says, I also noticed that something was living in them. Most of us would immediately rush to the doctor, try and get this sucker out of us. You can actually use something called a suction venom extractor, followed by tweezers, to pull them out. He instead decided to leave them in. He pulled out one painful one that was giving him a bit of bother, and thought, I'm just going to leave the other two in for fun. Why? He'd never seen an adult botfly in real life, so he thought he'd just create his own one. Well, not create, but allow it to be reared under his bloody flesh. Anyway, he said this. I have to read a few quotes from this guy because he's just wonderful. He's a real character. He says, I also figured that being a male, this was my only chance to create another living, breathing being out of my flesh and blood, which I think most women around the globe are going to be a little bit irked that he's comparing this to pregnancy and childbirth. Not least because it only takes 2 months for these little guys to emerge, and the actual process of it coming out is 40 minutes long and apparently not particularly painful. So, you know, the best birth you could ask for, really, because the botfly maggots basically drug you. They will, you know, put off painkillers to numb the flesh so that you don't feel it coming out, probably so you don't slam your arm on it and stop it, so, you know, kill it when it's been nurturing away all that time.
Do you think when he named it, do you think when he birthed it, he gave it a name?
I absolutely bet he did. But
you know, he's a scientist. You know, it's a great name.
What?
Buzz.
Buzz. Well, the sad story is, actually, I bet he didn't, because they're such bizarre creatures, okay? They're living in your flesh all this time. The females have to go to all this great effort to capture a mosquito, pass the eggs on. Then these lovely little guys pop out. They're covered in spines, which makes them hard to kind of get out of the flesh before they're ready. And they sport a pair of fangs. It's just lovely. They drop to the ground, turn into pupa, turn black a few days later, and just kind of hibernate for about a month and a half. And then the adult comes out. It's this lovely thing with a blue abdomen and bright red eyes. However, doesn't have any functional mouth parts.
Mouth parts?
Yeah. Lacking.
How does it eat?
It doesn't. It dies a couple days later.
That's how ticks die. They basically starve to death.
It's, yeah. I mean, they go through all this and then emerge triumphant with their flashy blue abdomen and bright red eyes looking all jolly.
So
and
if
then
I
they
can
just try and mate, basically, for their remaining days.
Can I, without heads, without mouth parts?
Without mouth parts.
So
you
no
definitely,
kissing.
Yeah,
so
make it, that mouth part.
This sounds more like bio art to me, which is something that Olivia underscore Solon used to discuss quite a lot.
She did.
Growing, you know, mouse ears on yourself and injecting yourself with horse blood, that sort of thing. Building art out of the tissue cultured from dead pig skin. Living pig skin, sorry.
Good lord. But
I don't know what the purpose is here.
Well, the purpose
I don't
for
really
this
understand
guy
it.
Was he wanted to see an adult bot fly, and he did. And he's also shared, I think, the delight of these bizarre creatures and their life cycle. Because when I was, he's got a video online explaining it in his very characterful way. And what I took away from it was, why do these things exist? If someone can write in and tell me. Because they go through a hell of a lot to just die a couple days after they've, you know, finally reached the pinnacle of their existence. They just basically try and mate and then drop dead.
Wow.
Is that a metaphor for all human life?
In a way, it's also the first time I've ever heard bot flies mentioned under the heading of insect existential crises.
Yeah.
Are you a bot fly? Do you know why you exist? Have you got any mouth parts?
Maybe I'm putting my own issues on the bot flies.
You might be, but okay. You can find this story in full and links to the videos on wired.co.uk if you search for, well, maggots will get you there. It's a good time to let your creative juices flow, Liat.
They're doing it right now.
Excellent. And it also might be a particularly lucrative time for said juices to said move. And the reason is because the UK government has announced that creative industries have hit an all-time high and are worth a phenomenal £8.8 million to the British economy per hour.
That's ridiculous.
Every single hour. In fact, we can break it down further than that. That's £146,000 added every minute to British coffers. That is excellent. And the numbers actually mark a growth of a staggering 10% over 2013, which is the most recent year that we have data available for versus 2014. And it's three times that of the wider UK economy in terms of growth. So that's 1.7 million jobs in 2013 for the creative sectors, which is a total of 5.6% of all UK jobs. And these numbers are rising. So the bottom line is that if you're involved, and this is creative industries, you know, quite broadly speaking. So we're talking about video games, film, television, music. We're not just talking about, you know, one of those. We're talking about all of those. And that's factoring in the fact that we have, this is not just stuff that's sort of homegrown in the UK, but maybe there are companies that are producing in the UK work or products that go into supporting products or services or what have you. Not services, I suppose, but products and output in other countries. An example, the film Gravity.
Yeah.
Massive success, won loads of awards. Post-production done by, what are they called, in Soho?
Frame Store.
And yeah.
So much is done post-production in the UK as well.
And a huge amount of it in Soho, specifically the Soho say district, it's not really a district, but the Soho area of central London near where we are actually. Loads of post-production facilities there, and this is an area that is apparently incredibly lucrative and growing. This is great news.
This is very exciting. I mean, what are we doing right other than being amazing? I wonder if the government's actually supporting us.
Well, it's just us, our natural genius. There are, I mean, we have tax reliefs that is in place for things. In fact, there's a lot of controversy over the last couple of years about the games industry not getting tax breaks. And the problem is that it means that we're attracting people to start learning and developing games or things that go into making games, which is, you know, a huge industry now. Games makes more than Hollywood as an industry. So people are studying here and great, but then they're taking all those skills and then they're going to somewhere else, Canada, you know, North America, and they're putting games into play over there with the skills they learn here. And it shouldn't work like that. You know, we should be attracting people to learn and develop their skills here and then apply them here.
Yeah, because we have so many of the biggest, you know, and most successful research institutes in Europe and in the UK. So hopefully we can retain and create some of the bigger studios here.
Bloody well need to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What, that was the kind of Australian.
Was it? Yours was. Bloody hell. I can't do that. And I'm from the north. No one seems to know that I'm from Sheffield originally. I don't really seem to have an accent anymore. But I think this is fantastic. We have a full write-up on the website. Matt Cammon did a fantastic job of summarizing these numbers on wired.co.uk. If you search for creative industries on the website, take a look at it. But certainly, this is a sign that if you are studying one of these creative trades and or you are teaching people or you are looking to be taught or to teach, it's a great time to do it.
Yeah, we're always saying STEM, but don't forget the arts.
And yet I haven't earned a damn penny from doing a successful podcast. I mean, apart from my salary and your salary and, you know, the ad revenue.
It would be nice
and,
to get a kickback.
And all that sort of thing. But you know what I mean?
I do.
It's a good time to maybe have started your own independent podcast.
Oh, watch this space.
Liat.
Nice.
We gave an award this week after publishing a story that we thought was award for possibly most ridiculous startup of the year so far. Is a bit early.
Yeah.
You've pointed out here in your notes.
Counted.
A bit early to say that. But this is, what is this? Why are we talking about Glitter today?
Do you know what, guys? This is because it's funny. We're talking about it because, just have a laugh. There's a lot of awful things happening in the world and I think we're due a small laugh. Although there's you know, a dark side to this startup. I'm not going to lie.
Well, hang on. I mean, the headline here is startup will glitter bomb your least favorite people.
Yeah.
So this is, what do they do? So you hate someone or you want to annoy someone and instead of sending a pizza to their house or SWAT team, like seems to be happening to Gamergate opponents in the US at the moment.
Like a dog poop.
Or a dog poo through the door. This is glitter bomb into your front door.
Yeah, it does exactly what it says on the tin. It's a company called shipyourenemiesglitter.com. They will pack as much of those annoying pesky particles into a folded letter as possible to maximize annoyance and allow you to take sweet revenge on your enemies.
This from the person, though, the creator, who self-described glitter as the herpes of the craft world.
I kind of get it. Yeah, it's really annoying. I mean, I feel like sequins are the kind of the large, you know, the maxi version. I wear a lot of sequins and they get all over the house. It's a nightmare. And come Christmas time, I'm also Christmas obsessed. Glitter everywhere from my shiny decorations. It's a little bit annoying, you know, because they're just a trail. You'll find trails all over the house. But a glitter bomb in your face, you know, all over your clothes, perhaps all over your sofa.
What about
in between
your
sofa cushions?
What if you were naked?
I mean, just jump in the shower. That might be the easiest place to get it.
Doesn't work.
Okay, so someone's already sent you one.
No, I've just been covered in glitter. I have a friend who's obsessed with glitter and sparkles.
There you go. And you know how annoying it can be.
It's quite fun, actually, if I'm honest.
Yeah, it's fun.
It's quite fun to feel fabulous.
To feel fabulous. I mean, yeah, I personally don't think that this is just for enemies. I think this is, you know, if you want your friend to have a good laugh.
I like the very last quote at the bottom of our notes here. He says, I'm the exact opposite of a traditional entrepreneur. I found a problem, attempted to solve it, failed, so now I'm shipping that problem into the masses.
Yeah, I quite love this guy.
What is this guy? Matthew Carpenter. He's Australian.
Yeah, he's Australian.
He's angry.
They'll ship these glitter bombs anywhere. I'm calling them glitter bombs. They don't actually call them that, but I'm calling it that. For $10, which is about $5, anywhere in the world. So get on it. He's also inviting people to set up competitive enterprises because he thinks no one else is as stupid as them to deal with this stupid, expletive glitter.
Very nice. Ship your enemies glitter. .com if you hate people.
I mean, I don't like the word hate. Let's just, maybe for fun as well, you can send it.
Don't send any to me. Well, you can send them to Wired after about 2 weeks' time.
Send it. I'm all over it.
I won't be here to be covered in it.
My clothes need to be sparkled up.
We've got one quick last story I wanted to mention before we get into the second half, this last part of the show, which was that apparently 2014 was a record-breaking year for massive skyscrapers. And that's because of the 97 skyscrapers, 200 metres or taller, that have been completed around the world last year. Now, sadly, the UK only had one skyscraper.
Rubbish.
Only the one, unfortunately.
That was the Leadenhall Building.
Leadenhall Building, yeah. That was 224 metres, in fact.
It's pretty good.
It is. It's also a very good MP3 bitrate back in the day, 224 kilobits per second. The UK only had one last year. China was responsible for 60% of all of those 97, which I think is about 57 or 58. And there are now 11 so-called super talls that were completed. And they are buildings that are 300 metres or taller. There's 85 now in existence that are over 300 metres tall.
I'd like to see some more big ones in the UK.
Yes, indeed. Well, the biggest one is now One World Trade Center in New York, which was the largest building completed last year. That's 541 metres tall. That is more than twice the height of the Leadenhall Building in London.
I saw...
Come on, Brit.
The tallest is the Burj Khalifa, right? Burj Khalifa? In
Dubai.
Dubai.
Yeah.
I saw it in December, and I tell you what,
well, they've got
I kind of love it.
They've got an even larger one that hasn't been built yet.
Yeah, they're on their way.
That
I
crazy,
mean, they will top
it's
it.
It's like a mile high or something stupid.
Yes, mile high, because it's nice to say big numbers like that.
Yeah.
But it is so cool. I remember my friend lives kind of very near the Burj Khalifa, and I would love to kind of come home in a taxi. I'll be looking at the skyline going, where is she? Where is she? Where is she? And you're like, oh, is it there? Is it? Oh, okay, that's it. It's the one that looks... standing out above all, literally, it dwarfs the entire city. It looks remarkable, and I can always find where she lives.
Well, last year, Japan and Chile both completed their first super tall skyscrapers. They both now have a skyscraper that measures at least 300 meters. That's pretty impressive. And these figures, by the way, come from the annual Council on Tall Buildings and Urban Habitat report into skyscraper construction. Now, that is not a publication we have previously subscribed to, nor do I think we have a subscription to even now. But what a name.
Yeah, fun job for them.
So, Britain, we need to step this up a notch. Several hundred notches, a notch being exactly 1 meter, because we're being beaten by the Yanks again in the tall buildings competition. And I think we need an even bigger building. Let's make one 1.1 miles high.
Yeah.
Let's put a podcast studio at the top of it.
We'll just do what they did with the Burj Khalifa and put a spike on the top.
Yes, let's do that. Still to come, we are going to be talking about David Cameron hating your privacy. But first, a very short break.
Do you want a free audiobook? You probably do since you're listening to our podcast. Audible.co.uk is offering every listener of the Wired.co.uk podcast any book from its catalogue of 80,000, including the latest science, technology and business releases from best-selling authors, just for trying out its service. A one-month trial of audible.co.uk costs nothing, and whatever book you choose to download is yours to keep, even if you cancel your account. Head to audible.co.uk/wired, where you can sign up in a few seconds to download any book you want. You'll be supporting Nate, Olivia, Liat, and the rest of the wired.co.uk podcast team, and you get a free book in return. Sign up easily now at audible.co.uk/wired. Thanks for supporting the show. That's audible.co.uk/wired.
Welcome back, Liat.
Nick.
It's time for our segment of discussion, and this week we have named this Made in the UK. Liat, we have to talk about David Cameron and his plans for our encrypted messages, because terrorists like those involved in the horrific acts in France recently need no place to hide, and that means us maybe giving up our WhatsApp, our iMessage.
Yep.
What is going on?
Yeah, I think we saw this coming a mile away. I think it's been something that's been creeping for some time and has definitely been on the Conservatives' agenda. There's been something of a rehashing of something called the Snoopers Charter. That's a bit of legislation that's been in the works for a few years now and is continually battered away by, everyone that doesn't want their privacy completely destroyed. And this charter would essentially make it so that surveillance of the content of your communications is up for grabs and would force ISPs to keep that data for a year or more. I mean, they already do keep a lot of that data for a year or more.
But this isn't just metadata. So this is not just Liat Clark, or rather Liat Clark's phone made a call to Nate Langston's phone at 12:51 p.m. and it lasted for 3 minutes. Mm. This is, and we talked about how concerning we find the Conservatives' outline pre-general election, which is a very interesting time to be telling everyone they're going to have their WhatsApps turned off.
Yeah, but I think they think people
that'll get
want
the young that'll
this.
Get the kids voting.
Well,
it will for Labour,
I think it will get a lot of people voting, and you know, for that kind of argument, people, you have a knee-jerk reaction. People are scared. People want to prevent these kinds of things happening, and there's a lot of fear around what have been referred to as lone wolf attacks that are very difficult to predict, and very, you know, they've stopped terrorist attacks over the years, but a lone wolf attack where one or two people are acting apart from an organization are very difficult to stop.
But people are also often misinformed, given bad information, given one-sided information. So let's do our bit. Let's have a bit of background here. So what is this proposing? What has David Cameron proposed is going to change?
Okay, well, I'll start with him, but there's also European leaders en masse are actually proposing for some things as well.
Yeah.
But David Cameron came out this week to say, you know, obviously my response is free speech, yay, but let's start more state surveillance. He says if they win the general election, they will introduce major new legislation to close off the safe places, that's a direct quote, where terrorists communicate online. He said the government must be able to read any communications whatsoever, whether encrypted or not. I mean, what that practically means for modern day life, I do not know. Are you going to make encryption illegal?
But the thing is, the bottom line, what we're saying there is that you're saying that we can't have any forms of communication that the government cannot read.
Yeah.
Now, generally, that does mean encryption. That doesn't, strictly speaking, is not necessarily the be-all and end-all of it, but that's by and large what we're talking about here. And huge, massive numbers of communications platforms use encrypted messaging as A, their only form of messaging, such as iMessage. It's all encrypted. Or B, they might offer a non-encrypted option, but it's by default on.
Yeah, because who would want to choose the unencrypted one?
And a lot of stuff that happened, actually, incidentally, at the fallout of the NSA reveals and the Edward Snowden reveals, started switching this on because they didn't want their customers being snooped on as easily as they could be. So people like Gmail, Yahoo, Bing, they start encrypting search terms, they start encrypting your email. Google is now encrypting the connection between their own internal servers. So rather than it just being from your machine to Google's data center, it's encrypted from your machine to Google's data center and from individual servers in Google, or at least between the data centers themselves, that is also encrypted. So we're talking about that not being doable if Cameron and his cohorts in the European Parliament go ahead with this proposal.
Yeah, and as you say, this is something that customers have kind of been demanding. There was like due outrage following the Snowden leaks that people were horrified at, you know, how easy it was for their data to be swept up in these ways. And technology companies, to their credit, stepped up and were doing things that a lot of people thought they should have been doing from the beginning. You know, these various measures that you've been talking about.
Well, before we go any further, actually, with that, I also wanted to point out another big development that's happened here, which is that at the weekend, a group of ministers from 11 European countries, which I'm guessing are the cohorts mentioned above alongside Cameron, signed a joint statement calling for ISPs to more proactively report and remove extremist material online, which, while in one way doesn't necessarily sound like as devastating thing as it is, you know, do you want to have kids potentially stumbling along things that might radicalize them? It does also mean that the ISPs, the service providers, are effectively having to police the internet. And that is not necessarily even feasible, certainly let alone in a way that would come with due diligence and oversight that would be required for something that big.
Of course. The letter was fairly vague about how it envisions this happening. And I guess if it is asking ISPs to create a reporting system, YouTube has its own reporting systems and individual companies will have their own reporting systems for content that they don't think is appropriate. So if they were doing that, then I think, then maybe that could work. You're obviously giving them added work. But in terms of who decides, how you decide what to remove, it gets a little bit more complicated. And I wanted to bring up a conversation that was had with the UK's Minister for Immigration and Security in March last year, James Brockenshire, who kind of tripped up in talking about controls on YouTube. And he kind of implied that the government had a bit of an in, and it turned out it wasn't totally correct. But something he did say was that we need much better and vaster controls that would give the government details on material that may not be illegal, but certainly is unsavoury and may not be the sort of material that people would want to see or receive.
But that's even more vague, isn't it?
Yeah,
that's like saying, we're going to make it illegal for anybody under the age of 18 to access pornography, but we're also going to say that anyone between the ages of 11 and 18 aren't allowed to view anything that might be sexually provocative, which might even cover, or would probably cover music videos for, pop stars and stuff like that.
It's going to the heart of, fears over government censorship that you could start censoring ideas, a seed of an idea, an inkling of an idea, rather than actually a full-blown something that you should be worried about. The fact that he says it may not be illegal just seems, ridiculous when you read it, when you're talking about censoring something and passing information to the government about an individual in that circumstance. And especially, this is all very much in context. He was the Minister for Immigration and Security, and believe still is. And this was in context of a lot of news of UK British nationals travelling abroad to places like Syria and Iraq to fight and potentially coming back. And there was a lot of kind of scaremongering about, let's not let these people back. We don't know why people are going there. They might be going there for aid missions. There's been a lot of talk about this. And likewise, in these past few days, with the letter coming from these 11 European ministers and from David Cameron, they've talked about a lot of content on the web inciting radicalization of people. And they talk in the letter about putting this effort forward to prevent and detect radicalization in an early stage. And those words there, to prevent and detect it in an early stage, is again, it's kind of, verging on what he was talking about, content that is unsavory, that people might not want to see, that's not illegal. What is content that's at an early stage? Is it someone saying they don't like the British government or its ideas? Or is it someone actually inciting hatred and violence?
They phrase it like they're trying to catch a disease. Like, you need to detect a problem with your body earlier rather than when it gets too late, so you can treat it. Or be careful about, the reason for kids not to try cannabis is because it leads onto harder drugs. They may be true, but is that necessarily an approach that can work in a situation like this, when it means having to come down on these decisions as to whether something is unsavory or not?
Yeah, you could argue that a lot of things that the British press talk about and photos you see, and this is a kind of just to play devil's advocate, from the other side, an individual who doesn't have, who is angry at the government and sees a lot of terrible things happening abroad and sees a very one-sided coverage, you could say that is not actually helping a situation where someone could become radicalized, because you're not presenting two sides fairly and you're not giving everyone a voice.
Then there's the other argument, which is that people say some really stupid stuff online, but actually are just idiots. They're not terrorists.
Yeah.
We've seen the example of the case with the airport a few years ago. Sort of said, basically jokingly said that, an airport had to sort itself out, otherwise he was going to blow it up. Like, it was a stupid thing to say, but he meant it as a joke, and he certainly paid the price for it now, but he was basically just angry and tweeting out of anger, but he wasn't a terrorist. He was just basically going through a moment of frustration and stupidity. But would that person then suddenly be on a watch list? I mean, you could probably justify that if someone openly tweets, I'm going to blow up an airport, they probably should at least be kept an eye on. But these people who we're trying to keep an eye on are not necessarily out in public saying, I'm going to blow up an airport.
Mm.
We're pushing them either more and more underground into harder and harder places to monitor, or potentially making the obvious solution analog communication.
I was going to say...
Word of mouth,
exactly.
Written letters, the post office.
Yeah. If you bring in these measures, that will happen.
I mean, could it be that that ends up becoming a more efficient way to arrange these sorts of atrocities? And I don't want to hypothesize that that's the case, but we've seen time and time again that the more lockdown systems become in order to try and stamp something out, the more it forces the people who want to avoid being stamped out, it pushes them towards much harder to monitor and track solutions.
Yeah. Meanwhile, the rest of us today carry out most of our private conversations online. Mm. You know, most of you people are very busy. If you think back in the day, we'd make a lot of phone calls. We'd probably see people more often. We'd probably live near a lot of our friends and family, other, you know, not across the globe or across the city from each other in our busy lives. All our private worlds are our everyday worlds. So what the vast amount of harmless information you'd have to sift through to have one comment that could be construed the wrong way, let alone real, you know, information that could potentially lead to a suspect, is unfathomable.
Well, we have a lot to learn about this, I imagine, in the run-up to the May election. There are going to be some televised debates, possibly without Cameron, during April. So we'll have to see what comes up there. And certainly to see if the opposing parties directly attack these proposals and say, we will protect your digital privacy, and use that in their manifesto to win votes. Potentially could be a big vote winner for the younger population if it is put out there that Cameron wants to ban WhatsApp, but, you know, Miliband says, I'll protect your WhatsApp, and suddenly a million kids who've never even heard of voting race out to the polls, which could be interesting, if not slightly misguided. But let us know. I won't be here when the election happens. Liat, will you be covering the elections in detail?
We absolutely will.
Good.
I know that Nick Clegg is very much against the Stupas Charter, or says he is. Who knows what will happen? Miliband's a bit on the fence. We'll see. It'll be very interesting to see what their policies are with regard to these issues.
Yeah. Well, let us know what you think about everything we've just discussed, and obviously what you think about the manifestos, as much as we know about them so far, and keep us posted on what you think should be done, and we'll debate your ideas as well as, well, our own, and of course, Cameron's podcast at wired.co.uk. Well, that's going to do it for this week. The feedback loop we were going to get into this week, but some of you have been a little bit quiet since New Year. We've got a lot of older messages about episode 200, loads of them, in fact, but surprisingly few since we've restarted the show talking about the new shows. Maybe that's because we've only been back for 1 week, or because you're all incredibly depressed that I'm going, which according to at least some people.
Or it's the January blues.
Yep, January blues, all this sort of stuff. But keep it coming. podcast@wired.co.uk. We will be back next week, won't we, Liat?
We will indeed.
Is next week my last show?
It is, mate.
Oh my God, it is, isn't it?
I know. What will you wear?
I'm going to try nothing.
Okay.
I'm going to Emperor's New Clothes it next week.
Right. Maybe I will bring some kind of blindfold so that I can get through the show.
So, yes, one more last show of me. So get in your messages, questions. I don't know.
Not that I'm sure your birthday suit isn't lovely.
Mm.
Don't take that the wrong way.
No, I'm not doing. No.
I can't concentrate.
I see all these as compliments.
Okay.
It's the skewed view of my own world that I have. But you've got one more week of that skewed world. So hopefully you will join us next week. We'll see you then.
Bye.